Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
I've been told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
Whole part of the show, man.
Welcome. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston, our special class action palooza edition of the show. We've got a class action suit to talk about. We've got Netflix statistics coming your way. How many millions of hours viewed of WWE content were represented?
It was a mathematical challenge, I think, is what you're referring to.
Correct. What do these numbers mean? That's going to be that segment later on. We will also be talking about TNA about to launch on AMC on Thursday night, a big edition of the show, so big that Perez Hilton will be there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Paramount,
that is, but I've heard that that's a famous person.
Paramount, this is like the most contentious acquisition attempt I can recall. Like, this is basically, we're holding you hostage until you relent and say yes to us, going the legal route. And we will also be talking about ratings, Netflix global views, and we're never going to refer to the UFC Apex again. Folks, the Meta Apex. They have got a title sponsor now for the next 5 years. Mark Zuckerberg plastering his brand all over the Apex. Can't wait.
He's on the board of Meta besides Mark?
Dana White happens to be on the board of directors. Yeah. So if everyone get excited, maybe this will bring NXT for another event at the Meta Apex. But let's start off. We have a suit that came out. This occurred after our show last week, but a fun one nonetheless, because we were all prepared for the big move last year, if you were in the U.S., of the WWE moving its premium live events from Peacock over to ESPN. It's that simple. It's just, you tuned into Peacock, now you tune into ESPN. There's no difference. And we're going to start off with WrestlePalooza, the big head-to-head day that featured AEW All Out moving to the afternoon in Toronto, as WWE would stage this event from Indianapolis, Indiana. A show that I fail to recall who first supported that one.
Brock Lesnar and John Cena, CM Punk and AJ Lee versus Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch, right?
Correct. Yes.
I didn't even watch it.
No. This wasn't even a second screen experience for Brandon. I don't think I didn't.
Because, yeah, I would have had to sign up. I'm a YouTube TV subscriber, so there was no.
Whoa.
Without. What? Yeah.
What does that matter?
Well, I understood as a deep researcher, well beyond perhaps the typical citizen, I understood what the offering really entailed.
Now, I'm going to rely on journalists, okay? And I'm going to cite one Sean Coulthard, a.k.a. Michael Cole, who said, if you have ESPN, you get our events. Isn't that it?
Is that a direct quote?
It's not. I'm paraphrasing.
How about Joe Tessitore? What did he say?
Joe Tess, I imagine, said similar as well. Nick Khan, at least in this lawsuit, cited as stating no upcharge.
So, well, I think that Nick Khan comment, in Nick Khan's defense.
Here's a breakdown of the suit. So this coming from Brandon's story, a new class action lawsuit filed Thursday night, this being last Thursday, in the District Court of Connecticut, accuses WWE and ESPN of deceptive and deceptive marketing practices centering on WWE's recent move of its premium live events to ESPN's direct-to-consumer streaming service. The complaint takes issue with how some fans who already get ESPN channels through cable or other providers were still required to pay an additional monthly fee to watch WWE events. The plaintiffs allege this contradicts marketing communications from both WWE and ESPN, which they claim suggested all existing ESPN subscribers would have access to the premium live events. The plaintiffs are seeking to represent any U.S. customers who paid for ESPN's direct-to-consumer service in the run-up to WrestlePalooza on September 20th while already being an ESPN subscriber through traditional means. The lawsuit only names WWE as a defendant and not ESPN or its parent Disney. By only suing WWE, the plaintiffs are trying to avoid the arbitration and class action waiver provisions that they note are in Disney's subscriber agreement. The suit claims more than $5 million are at issue. If the plaintiffs prevail, an eligible consumer might receive a refund or partial reimbursement. And the story goes on. First of all, these plaintiffs already guilty of not being Pollock and Thurston listeners, okay? Or else there would be no lawsuit here, okay? Or really having, I guess, any kind of the stumbling block for me, Brandon, is that
yes.
Even if the argument is that the messaging was not clear, and they can certainly make that argument, at the end of all of this, this is not like you just logged into a site and you were blindly charged for this. You actively had to sign up for this. So at what point, at what digit of your credit card that you're typing in are you realizing, hey, I might get an additional payment charged to my card on this? At what point does it dawn on you that this is not coming with your existing subscription package? Like, what onus is on these plaintiffs here that even with poor messaging does come the enlightenment that this does not come with my existing package?
Right. It's not like they were charged something automatically. They had to, for people maybe outside the U.S. who don't know what's going on here, about half the country, maybe less than half, were able to authenticate into the ESPN app as part of their regular package. There may have been complications about which tier you were on. I don't know. But some people were able to log in, no upcharge, they got to watch it. And as time goes on, presumably, and ESPN/Disney reworks their deals with all these TV carriers, maybe more of that. Cox is one that, since this deal has started, is now people are able to log in. YouTube is not there yet, but it is supposed to maybe this year. So the people who are not in that bucket, who, you know, say like me, or say they were Comcast subscribers, they get ESPN as part of their regular pay TV package. It sounded like anybody was going to be able to, who had ESPN already, was going to be able to just log in and do it, but they were not. So what you're saying is you still had to, like, I don't know if you had to enter your credit card information. You probably did. You had to pay $30, and it was pretty deliberate. I did a lot of thinking, you know, hearing you say that. And I think maybe the theory that they would espouse is you marketed it in such a way that I expected to get this as part of my existing product. And I think that the class period comes in play here too, that we can talk about. But I think maybe the notion is that I anticipated, based on the advertising, that I was going to be able to watch this. And maybe I found out somewhere down the line, maybe after I had this anticipation, we can get into like concrete, you know, ideas of like, okay, I'm going to have my WrestlePalooza party. Mark Shapiro says this is going to be a huge event. I'm going to have all my friends over, making all these plans as a Comcast subscriber or YouTube TV subscriber, and then come to find out the day of the show, and the class does go up to September 20th, which is the date of WrestlePalooza, come to find out, oh, I don't get this to watch this show, now I'm going to have to pay $30 because I'm already with my plan sort of sunk in. I don't know if that's exactly what they're saying, but that maybe that theory would work. But yes, they did have to make a purchase. I think it's a question that I would have for the plaintiff attorneys of why is – so the class period is August 6th to September 20th. So that's from the announcement date, August 6th. This service doesn't even launch until August 20th. So I don't think you could have made a purchase until August 20th. Nonetheless, the marketing was out there from August 6th onward.
And we can add that on August 6th, the deal with WWE and ESPN is announced, not WrestlePalooza, at that point. Like, WrestlePalooza was not announced, I feel, until later in the month of August.
And I don't know if they've changed their marketing or how much they have changed their messaging. But you'd think that maybe this could apply, in theory, to beyond WrestlePalooza, depending on what the messaging was. Maybe it was changed. But, you know, what about what was after that? Night of Champions after that? What about Survivor Series? Maybe I wasn't interested in WrestlePalooza for whatever reason, but my fandom in WWE kicked back up after that time, and I was really interested in Survivor Series, and I may have encountered the same issues. So it's curious to me why they've selected the class period that they have and have stopped it at September 20th.
It's also very difficult to disentangle, because that's also the period, like, it was strategic. They were launching this ESPN service in August and in advance of the NFL season starting. Of course, they're going to have a swarm of signups during that period, and like trying to break that down of like who were specifically signing up for WWE versus just the launch period of ESPN itself and all the other things that it was offering as well. That becomes a little difficult. Like, pretty much anyone that signed up can argue that they're part of this class period, even if they're...
You have to be... So if you're a Hulu Live TV subscriber, you don't get to be part of this. If you're a part... If you're Fubo, anybody who did get to authenticate, you're not a part of this because you didn't pay anything extra, right? So just people who did pay extra. And... I think I've gotten messages like this. You know, there might be like a class, I think like AMC, maybe there was something like this, because I had like an AMC movie pass for a minute. There's a class action lawsuit, and then all of a sudden, oh, you get a credit of X dollars because you get some email or something. People have probably had experience with this. You get some random email that says, oh, because of this shareholder lawsuit, you get a credit of X dollars as part of a settlement or something like that. So that's what they're looking for here. You know, if you're, and there probably are a lot of people, right, who signed up, paid $30, are already getting ESPN as part of their traditional TV package, but had to pay $30 if they wanted to watch WrestlePalooza or Survivor Series or Night of Champions, whatever it was. So if they prevail, that's what they're fighting for, is for your $30 there.
Yeah, I think this is one that is going to be a tall task for these plaintiffs, because at the end of this, it is arguing, like, at some point, there is a responsibility on you, the user, to understand that you are entering into an agreement to spend these $30. And if you willfully decided to make that $30 purchase, you're kind of acknowledging that there was a value of $30 attached to this event that you were willing to pay. It's not like you didn't receive the event in exchange for your $30. Like, at what point does this go from being pulled in from, you know, questionable marketing communication to a willful transaction? That at the end of this is kind of what this feels like for these plaintiffs. That, you know, part of this here is Nick Khan was on with John Orrand when the announcement was first made in August. And he cited that when we did the Peacock deal in 2020, he said the same thing, like the WWE Network, no upcharge for what were then pay-per-views. He said, same thing here with what has been referred to as ESPN flagship. You subscribe to that product, you get WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Royal Rumble, all of our premium live events with no upcharge. So, I mean, that's...
I think there's nothing wrong with what he's saying there.
Especially at the time. Let's remember, when this deal was announced, they were not scheduled to do WrestlePalooza yet. We were looking at like WrestleMania being the launch, where in theory you were going to have all of these carrier agreements figured out by then. And then they decided to jump the gun and start this deal in September, where, you know, as you mentioned, like half the country did not have the ability to authenticate, and you had this kind of right. Deciphering of the audiences of who had to pay and who did not have to pay.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that the quote, especially in context, doesn't seem to serve the argument that they're making. The complaint is making it sound like if you get ESPN, you get access to the PLEs, no upcharge. Whereas what he's saying is he's sort of explaining the history of the distribution of W pay-per-views is that it was on pay-per-view, then it was on the W Network as part of a $10 monthly subscription, then it was on Peacock as part of their monthly subscription, and now it's going to be on ESPN flagship, which is one of the many names this app has had, as part of that monthly subscription, which is true. If you pay, you know, $30, you get access to this. And he's not talking about the automatic no extra cost authentication access that you get as part of being a cable subscriber. That's a different thing from what the plaintiffs are taking issue with here, I think.
Yeah. And just to, so it was, I believe August 6th is the ESPN deal is announced. August 20th is when the press release goes out announcing WrestlePalooza, which we had the two of us reported prior to that. But, you know, we're talking about a 2-week gap between the announcement and then WrestlePalooza and thus starting this deal earlier than expected.
Yes. One thing in the feedback from this article or this story coming out, does it say anything about the speculation about the nature of this relationship between WWE and ESPN? We did reach out to ESPN for comment. They declined to comment. We did contact WWE to comment, and they did not respond, which is normal.
But always welcome if always they welcome. Want to yes. weigh in further here. So, yeah, that's the latest on that story. If there's anything else to add
yes,
beyond
there
this.
Are. So here's some boring procedural stuff. Guess who's the judge? So this is in the district court, federal court in Connecticut. Guess who's the judge?
Oh, tell us.
Sarah F. Russell.
I did not know that. And Sarah Russell.
I found that out like minutes before we came to air. She's also the judge in the Grant versus WWE lawsuit. She is also the judge in the Dr. Carlin Kolker versus Ann Callis defamation lawsuit. And I was looking into, I think all these courts have different rules. I think for the most part, Connecticut is random assignment, but they do have the ability, I think, to make some choices when there's certain associations in terms of the same parties or something like that. So I don't know if this is a deliberate choice or it's just roll of the dice every time that they're getting Sarah F. Russell.
So it could be years before we get any kind of decision on
this. Sarah F. Russell has made numerous opinions. I've checked on this. What John is alluding to is that the Grant case has been sitting waiting for a decision for more than 6 months on a pretty preliminary decision. They're not waiting to decide arbitration. They're waiting to decide whether Janelle Grant gets access to discovery related to the arbitration question. So there would be probably at least one, if not multiple, disputes that would flow from that. Before the arbitration question would come up. And it's been 6 months. Now, I did look at, I'm sure she has numerous cases. I did look, she has filed a number of opinions, and opinions are long justifications for why she made an order that she made, which is something that judges do all the time. So she is active. It's not like all of her cases are sitting there. It's just this one in particular, for whatever reason, on the question of whether Janelle Grant will be able to request documents and perhaps depositions. That is waiting over 6 months now since June 30th, I think, was the date that issue was fully briefed.
You guys could potentially do a spinoff of this show doing entertainment cases or just criminal if you liked. I would love to do a CSI Pollock and Thurston. I think that would be right up our alley.
We do have a big civil case that just came up. I didn't even know about it until you put it in the show notes. Paramount versus WBD. That's in the Delaware Court of Chancery.
It is. Yeah, the Delaware Court of Chancery, it's just being inundated with pro wrestling and pro wrestling adjacent cases as well. Does ESPN have second guesses making that deal with WWE when it comes to PLEs? Also, their PLE grades haven't been an A. Okay, well, those are just like show reports on the ESPN site. In terms of the deal, I would certainly reserve any grand declaration of this ESPN-WWE deal. Again, this last couple of months, this was all a gravy period, and it's not a fully rolled out ESPN Unlimited service. We're now into like the heart of WWE in the lead up to WrestleMania and what kind of promotion and results they see, both with this Rumble coming up in a few weeks and then, of course, the two-night WrestleMania. This is what everything is going to be geared toward, and I think ESPN is going to have a much better sense of the power of a WWE brand on this service come late in the spring post WrestleMania would be my assessment.
I love the question. The premise, I mean, isn't it evidence, I think, is what a lot of people are thinking. Some people are thinking that because ESPN covers WWE and has been reviewing their premium live events and giving them letter grades, and those grades, because they've not been biased in favor of WWE, that is evidence. Now, I know there's other stuff. But that is being raised as a contributing piece of evidence, supposedly, that the relationship, because they're not getting more generous grades from the people who are reviewing the shows for the website, maybe they're just being independent. I know that's not a cynical enough thought, but maybe they're just being given some independence, to be honest.
I feel for anyone that has to do that for ESPN, because if you give a high grade, you're going to be criticized. Right. And it turns out when you give a lower grade, you are criticized. Like, there is no winning in that scenario, because you're either just in the bag for WWE or, oh my God, even ESPN hates this product that they're paying for. It's like, I think you should be applauding if anyone on that site is giving like what comes across as a very like transparent thought on the product. And there at least is the appearance of like a clear separation behind like what we have rights for and trying to do media coverage for these sites as well. I completely agree with you. I always kind of find it baffling when that is under fire, and it just shows if the opposite was the case, they would be under fire as well for grading too high, for instance.
And one more procedural point about this case in the latest filings. I think there were some new filings today. Anyway, I read them today. This has been filed, like I said, in Connecticut. The two plaintiffs who are trying to represent this class, one is from New Jersey, the other is from New York. They say they're residents of New Jersey and New York. When you file a class action lawsuit, you have to establish that at least some Judge Russell has filed a short order saying you have to amend your complaint and explain why this is the right jurisdiction for your issue. And I think what she's saying is just because WWE is headquartered in Connecticut isn't enough to say that this is the right jurisdiction. I think they would have to allege that some of the conduct that they're suing over happened in Connecticut, which I guess they could say, well, W executives made decisions in their offices in headquarters, and that has contributed to what we're complaining about. We went through something similar with the Kevin Kelly lawsuit, and that there were issues around, I think, essentially saying the magic words to put this in the right jurisdiction. So I don't think this is necessarily going to leave Connecticut, but it could if the defendants push back. But I don't know what jurisdiction they would really prefer over Connecticut District Court, which is, I believe, where they require disputes in their talent contracts to go and be resolved in. So you would think that they have somewhat of a preference for this court. So
the last thing, what is, like, if you can just explain why are ESPN and Disney exempt from this suit as the defendants? It sounds like they kind of have this in their user agreement that prohibits them from being caught in this type of a lawsuit. That's how I read it, at least, even though, like, the damages here would be on, you know, Disney's behalf, that they were the ones that were taking in this. Like, this was not a transaction with WWE, but they are accusing WWE of essentially being the messengers of this promotion, and that is why they are the defendants, but ESPN and Disney are not.
Yeah, this will be the first time I'm actually looking at it, but I'm pulling up here. Here's Disney's subscriber agreement as of October 2025, and they do say that any dispute between you and us, except for small claims, is subject to a class action waiver and must be resolved by individual binding arbitration. Please read the arbitration provision in this agreement. So
they could have asked Sarah Russell to rule on whether this would be going to arbitration or not.
And then probably Disney would have moved to compel arbitration. If you're listening to this program more than a few weeks and you still don't know what arbitration is, it's when it is a private process. Cynics might call it a secret trial, where you go into private arbitration with an arbiter, maybe it's a retired judge or something like that, and you agree to resolve your dispute that way. And it is binding, which means you have to follow whatever the decision is there. It keeps everything out of the public eye, for one thing.
It's the Langus option.
Yes. And then, look, they've got a waiver here as well as for class action. So that's clearly what they're trying to avoid there, because Disney would have a good case, I suppose, to try to get themselves dismissed as a defendant there.
Yes. The mouse don't F around. Okay. They're very lawyered up and ready for these cases. So there you go. Your plaintiffs, Michael Diessa and Rebecca Toback, are the ones representing this. So it's an interesting case. One that I think they're going to have a lot of difficulty trying to you know, put, lay all of this at the feet of the WWE messaging. I can only hope that we get some kind of resolution where an R-Truth ad on SmackDown is featured, where he does explain the different carriers and such.
I want him to get a pie chart out or a donut chart and with all the logos of the different carriers across the United States and say, this one's got it, this one doesn't, this one you can log into, this one, if you're on the right tier, you can get it. I think that would be great. I would check that out.
SmackDown reviewers will remember these backstage segments they did, in particular the night before WrestlePalooza, that I did try to go back and going through my notes in that segment. They are not part of the Netflix archived version. They've removed those ads, which I guess is not totally surprising, but there's no signal of them, at least on Netflix. We're going to stay with WWE, and Netflix put out this press release.
There is a press release for this? This is not just a Variety article?
Well, it's a news release that Netflix did put out. It's on the in their About section on the Netflix website itself. WWE by the numbers, celebrating 1 year on Netflix. So celebrating being already in the title, I think, kind of gives this away. Now, not getting too far ahead of ourselves, are we not nearing your favorite Netflix release of the year, which they will be putting out their data for all of their programming covering, what, the last 6 months or so? Is that not a pending release that we should be expecting soon?
Yes, that usually comes out around the time of their earnings report, right? I'm downloading the assets here. Oh, I thought it was going to be an Excel spreadsheet. It looks like it's just graphics, though.
Unfortunate. Yes, but there's John Cena holding up his Intercontinental Championship with Sheamus and Rey Mysterio. It has been 1 year since Netflix entered the WWE ring. During WWE's first year on Netflix, we welcomed dozens of celebrities and brought back a few old friends into the fray. But beyond just smashing chairs and smashing opponents, it's been a year of smashing records on Netflix. To celebrate the anniversary, we wanted to look at the league's incredible reach. Is this a league? I don't know about that. Netflix members welcomed WWE with a bang. In 2025, our members reached...
Thankfully, no permanent injuries.
Yeah,
that's... How dare you skip over that?
Well, I mean... There were some permanent injuries, were there not? At least some long-term ones. In 2025, our members...
Not by Netflix members, though. That's what it's saying.
No, that's true. Bella Bajaria left unscathed. 525 million hours of WWE content were watched. Of this total, Raw accounted for nearly 340 million views and 185 million for premium live events broadcast outside the U.S., like SmackDown, which I guess SmackDown is now considered a premium live event. WrestleMania, Elimination Chamber, Money in the Bank, Night of Champions, and Royal Rumble. Since Raw's official Netflix debut, January 6, 2025, the show has made the global English TV top 10 nearly every week it's been on the service, 47 out of 52 weeks.
That sounds right.
Over 52 shows, Raw has averaged more than 3 million views per week. Again, that's a global number. And it's not just in the U.S.
And that's beyond the seven-day window, I would think, too.
Yes. It's not just in the U.S., the birthplace of the WWE. Raw has made the top 10 in 34 countries, including 51 weeks in the U.S., 49 weeks in the number two wrestling hotbed, Bolivia, 48 weeks in the U.S., and 40 weeks in the U.K., 38 weeks in Mexico.
48 weeks in Canada. Don't leave Canada out.
48 in Canada. WWE's popularity also extends far beyond the Raw franchise. Other top events have made the top 10, ranking in Bolivia, Canada, U.K., Egypt, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia. Despite not being available in the U.S., Royal Rumble also made the global English TV top 10. So we have, and then, you know, WWE Unreal stats here, expanding WWE's social bump, which generated more than 5.8 billion impressions. I mean, we're just getting into stupid numbers here that are... here's the thing.
Have you watched the new Unreal season yet?
It's not out yet.
Well, it's not out yet.
Next week.
Have you been interviewed for it?
No. No, I have not.
They didn't they're going to focus heavily on the Seth Rollins storyline, right?
Oh, I'm sure that call's coming. I wouldn't imagine that episode's complete yet. I'm ready. I'm all set.
Have they sent like a request for permission to use it for like excerpts from Rewind of Raw or something?
No, not for that episode. No.
Or the post show of Money in the Bank or whatever. Whatever show you SummerSlam.
It was this was right after Evolution, actually, that we talked about this. The clip is out there. I'm giving my expressed vocal consent right now that they can insert my clip. I'm verbally stating
you hereby give permission.
I do. In perpetuity. they can use that clip. Okay?
In perpetuity.
Yes, I'm willing to give that for history, for the story. Yeah. Like, we want to make sure this is documented. For
I would say it would be fair use, maybe even to use it.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you're just further assurance there.
Yeah, 100%. So here's
the
thing.
Math, real quick.
Yeah, let's do some math here, because there's no other comp to this. There's no other 52 week a year programming that Netflix puts out. So this is kind of just on an island. Yes, these numbers are very impressive, but any breakdown that you can provide, Brandon, we can discuss.
So I think what they're saying, I don't remember, this is all first party data, but Raw accounted for nearly 340 million views. And I think what they're doing there is just totaling up all of the global views, which is that number that we report from the Tudum Top 10. I think they're just combining all 52 episodes into a sum and getting 340. That's what it seems like. But when I did this math the other day,
does that add up?
That gives us about 6.5 million views. You know, if you divide by 52, it's 6.5 million views, which is way beyond what Raw is doing. So I don't know what they're referring to there.
Yeah, and that's just Raw. They're stating that. That's not including all the extra stuff, including SmackDown, which is, I guess, listed under SmackDown's weird because it doesn't air in the U.S. on Netflix, but does for a lot of international territories. Right. NXT isn't even brought up here. Like, that's, again, for people like us in Canada, like, everything is on Netflix.
Yeah. For just about most places except for the United States, right? It's basically
pretty much
everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there might be the odd territory out there, but generally, internationally, you're getting all of your WWE content through Netflix.
Yes.
This was, so I mean, again, like, this isn't, the numbers are impressive because they're high and you can put M's and B's next to these numbers. And how much stock do you put in these numbers? Do they tell you a whole lot? Do they tell you,
numbers in particular tell me very little, except for Netflix wants to celebrate the success that they say WWE is on their platform.
Here is one. If you wanted to assess the health of WWE's 2025, what would be, like, maybe the three areas that you would find to be the most illuminating when it comes to the health of WWE and how their performance was going, without going just strictly revenue profit? We know that will be reported. That certainly gives you. But if you're just looking for a certain, like, the popularity of this company, what do you think would reflect that the most? Would you put a high premium on, like, attendance? Would a subscription number give you that insight?
Attendance, in their case, has really been distorted by high ticket prices. We've seen attendance start to go down. But that's them responding to demand and raising ticket prices as high as they can.
Attendance with gate would be gives you a much clearer picture. That's
true. The gates.
If you're even drawing several thousand less, but you're seeing these gates of, like, is that a willing trade-off? For most, it would be.
And they will report live event revenue. That'll include site fees and maybe some other things. But that's largely a sum of their gates that they report quarterly in their broken out live event segment. And then it'll include, like, $50 million from Saudi Arabia in quarters where that's happening. Live plus same day, and I believe they do have this data, live plus same day, what's Raw doing live plus same day compared to the number of households that are watching live plus same day on the USA Network. The coverage rating, I guess, of SmackDown compared to how it was doing the prior year. What else would you use? I'd have to give it some thought.
I mean, I'd want to know specifically
Paul Levesque's approval rating.
Paul Levesque, yeah, perhaps Ipsos could put out a poll. We could get satisfaction, dissatisfaction. Signal chats, that would also be enlightening. And I'd really be curious.
Reddit sentiment analysis. I have been keeping that in mind to do another one. I'm just waiting for the data to become available in a way that is manageable. I will do that again. I plan to.
I'd really be interested to see the U.S. performance this year. Like, we get a bit of a sense of like Raw would be very difficult to like if you were to extract Raw and it had been on the USA Network for the last year, how much would that have been affected by, you know, the loss of cable homes, big data plus panel? Those are areas that they are really not impacted by. But what has the move from Netflix to or onto Netflix meant for Raw's base audience in the US?
I mean, it's being offset by the limiting of where the PLEs are, especially since September. I think, you know, distribution is important. And I think distribution helped. I have a firsthand experience of that. I think in 2014, when like you were all of a sudden no longer required to pay whatever it was at the end, $60 for a WWE pay-per-view, but you could just watch it as part of a monthly subscription. And I think that encouraged a lot of, you know, downstream engagement. And I think putting it from the W Network, where it was on, you know, 1.3 million, you know, in 1.3 million homes, and then bringing that into Peacock, where you could have even more casual viewership for people who had Peacock to watch whatever they were going to watch on Peacock, and also happen to have access to WWE. I think that helps them a little bit too, from 2020. And you're really taking a step back by putting that onto a more limited platform with a much higher price point than it's been for the last 12 years or so. And with it, you know, in front of a much smaller audience, like we've said, it's certainly, it's got to be the smallest PLE audiences that they've had in many years now who are able to watch it, at least in the U.S. That's happening. At the same time, I think Netflix, in, probably in terms of a coverage, is similar to the USA Network. The only thing is, you know, people aren't used to watching stuff live. I know they're, you know, launching into that and trying to do more and more stuff live. But I think in terms of household coverage, Netflix is probably a little bit higher than, and it's going to continue to cross over time as cable presumably continues to decline. I think that
you're on much stronger footing, I would say. Like you're on the growth platform as opposed to the declining asset that USA Network is basically described as.
Sure.
Under the auspices now of Versant.
But that hasn't coincided with like this explosion in popularity, because I mean the increase in popularity that they had was before this. It was from 2022, the end of 2022 onward. And the beginning of 2025 wasn't the explosion of, you know, popularity. If anything, we've noticed some embattled sentiment from fans at times.
Well, now it's time for a recurring segment. Over the last couple of days, Brandon has been charting AEW's fourth quarter performance, and you just did your quarterly investors call, unaffiliated with AEW, with yes. Josh Nason over at the Wrestling Observer site, and you have put up your findings over at WrestleNomics.com.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown in the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Where you can go through the breakdown of AEW's fourth quarter performance. And it does reveal some very interesting findings on AEW, how it closed out its year. But if we're going in order here, its median ranking in the 18 to 49 demographic, where it ranks.
I remember we're missing about 2 months here because Programming Insider data has become a little bit disorganized. I have not refilled all the data points here. So we've only really got a little over a month of data here, October.
Yes, Programming Insider is still going through its Jackson Pollock phase that has been a little hard to discern all of the data. But what we are seeing is that among all cable originals and broadcast programming. Dynamite, its median rank, average median rank, has been 115th. Quite a precipitous drop from prior quarters, while Collision ranking 186th. You've always placed the ranking as a key value attached to these programs, and I think this does very much reflect where AEW's programming has fallen in this fourth quarter.
Well,
which,
well, remember that this is now Q4, so this is October onward, and that is well into Big Data Plus panel.
Well,
and we've seen,
this is literally like the first full quarter of Big Data Plus panel, and there is your impact. Not as pronounced for Collision, but for Dynamite, I mean, this has been like you have put a stick of dynamite into their ranking.
And you, maybe there's some cannibalization factor there. I don't know. Whatever you want to think there. But I mean, pretty clearly, Big Data Plus panel has measured all these wrestling programs consistently lower, including at times when we've been able to gather the same episodes measurement under the two methodologies. It's been something like 20% lower in many cases.
So you go to the 18 to 49 rating, and for the fourth quarter of 2024, Dynamite is averaging a 0.07, which, if we are to compare to the third quarter, is actually up slightly. Sorry, I'm looking at 2024 here. So they did a 0.09 for the fourth quarter of 2025. I was looking at Rampage here. I was looking at the wrong thing here.
I will make sure we're pulling up the one that's actually on the site. Yes,
so this is a drop of 48% year over year if we're comparing to the fourth quarter of last year. Again, with the decrease in homes that are getting cable, Big Data Plus panel, that's going to account for something in term. And as well, we did not have simulcasting a year ago as well. So there are multiple factors that go into this beyond just looking at a drop of nearly 50%.
Yeah. It's those things, and you know the ability that we have to look at what the actual popularity is distorted. But and in the case of Big Panel and HBO Max as well, it's hard to know what this means for AEW, what this means for the media rights value. Is it, you know, the rank has been apparently diminished a lot. The demo rating, which is what drives ad rates, which is the bulk of what value that AEW is returning to its network, that's fallen in half. And it's probably, I mean, the Big Data Plus panel, whatever we can say about how it may not be, you know, measuring these shows correctly or not. As one TV executive told me, regardless, this is the currency. Nielsen is the currency, whether it's Big Data Plus panel, whether it's panel only, whether you think it's accurate or not. That's the currency. That's the currency that advertisers are buying against. If they're delivering a 0.09, you know, that's how much that 0.09 is going towards satisfying what the advertiser has bought.
They need something that is definitive. That's not a hypothetical. And these are the numbers that they're going by as these are the agreed upon numbers that we are spending against. And it's one of those many questions you have that if you are AEW that is out there and selling advertising and trying to strike these deals and you're showing these charts, but then, hey, we don't know what we're getting on HBO Max. It could be double the audience. It could be 10% more. It could be 50% more. We don't know. Well, to me, if I'm a third party and I'm looking to advertise, I don't know who I'm hitting by these hypotheticals. Like if Tony Khan truly does not know, and we have no reason to not believe him, and thus no one in AEW knows what these HBO Max numbers are, how can you tell an advertiser that it is worth spending money on for what is a totally theoretical audience on HBO Max? You don't know what you're spending money on. This is all we have that is concrete, and that's
how
what
you're
going
to a second bidder in 2029 or whatever it might be and say, we deliver X on TBS and TNT, but our HBO Max audience is great. It's so great that it's delivering. Well, David Zaslav won't tell me, but it's supposed to be great. It's to AEW's disadvantage if they don't have a lot of that data. I tend to think they probably have a little bit, but they're certainly not getting the data like they're getting for TBS and TNT.
It would be a great question for various advertisers, not just in AEW, but just regardless of how they are approaching this and how visible these, you know, streaming numbers are. Like, obviously there is some that get reported, but others that are just under lock and key that you're not, like, what are you spending on and what is the general practice of how you are deciphering, you know, your broadcast cable audience versus a streaming audience, and how much you value a streaming audience in comparison as a complement to these numbers.
Yes.
So total viewership, this not as significant. Obviously, you can see, like, the older numbers are semi-holding these figures up more so than what we just saw with 18 to 49. But Dynamite, fourth quarter year-over-year is down 18%, and Collision is down 16%. Numbers that, for all the factors we just listed, I would not look as a terrible decline given all of these different factors at play. But right.
There's three factors. There's Big Data Plus Panel, there's HBO Max, and then there's just the run-of-the-mill cord cutting that everybody expects is going to be, like, I don't know, 8% or so?
At least, I think. Like, we're looking at, you know, TBS, TNT, we're looking in the 60 to 65 million homes range that it's probably at by now. So yeah, there's a significant decrease there as well. Rampage, flat. I mean, it held up.
Rampage was a null from last year, actually.
Oh,
null.
That's right.
Null Valley.
Do you think the elimination of Rampage played any factor in the average AEW consumer? Do you think that eliminating an hour of television changed anything? Was there any fortifying of Collision given that it's one less hour? Or do you feel like ultimately this was just a loss of an hour of...
Not really. I assume the reason why Rampage doesn't exist anymore is because they feel like they can replace Rampage with a rerun or, you know, movie that they have in their library and make it just as profitable, and it's not adding any incremental new viewers that they're not capturing through these other two programs. In the podcast I did with Josh Nason about this, which is free on F4W, his hot doom take, I'm sure he's listening, is that maybe Collision in the next round of negotiations will not be around, and it'll just be Dynamite, which you can look to this demo rating that they're delivering on Collision in this quarter of a 0.05. You know, maybe Big Bang Theory can do that. And in fact, Big Bang Theory at times, especially under the new methodology, I think is delivering around the neighborhood of what Dynamite is delivering. So if you can replace it, I think that is always the thought experiment. Can you replace this program with something else that is maybe even cheaper?
But can Big Bang Theory do a pay-per-view on HBO Max?
It can't. Maybe it should. Maybe they should think about that.
Wasn't that going to be the WCW reboot pay-per-view? I think it was going to be the Big Bang.
The Big Bang, yeah.
The Big Bang, that was it. They were not going to call the theory, but the Big Bang. Which, if you were, I mean, could you imagine the people that were going to buy something on pay-per-view in 2001 called The Big Bang for $30, you might have a class action lawsuit there for buying something that you thought was disguised as porn.
Yeah, I have no comment on that.
Okay, I'm just saying, maybe our plaintiffs would have had a better case in 2001 had that pay-per-view been offered for such a price. We'll next go to estimated tickets distributed. So this, you know, we go through WrestleTix, and, you know, this certainly AEW attendance, it has not really struck out in a big way, but what we have seen is basically maintaining levels at both the Dynamite and Collision tapings year over year, and pay-per-views as well. The big
slightly
drop,
up, in fact, overall.
Yeah, I mean, the big drop came from 2023 to 2024, but we're pretty much flat in all of these areas. Dynamite and Collision, by extension, they are running a lot more smaller venues that they're, you know, typically like 3,000 people is what these TVs are generally set up for. But pay-per-views overall, I mean, that is clearly been something that are still viewed as, you know, the premium product that AEW is putting out. I think Brandon just went to sleep with all of this data. It's a lot to take in when we're going through an entire quarter of results. But in the quarter, Dynamite averaged 3,300 people. So that's up from 3,100 last year. And Collision slash Rampage, when comparing to 2024, slightly down. We're talking 2,100 to 2,000. And the pay-per-view average, identical. 8,600 it averaged in 2024, and the same in 2025. So overall, that being a general area of unchanged, and you have to mark that as encouraging, especially given, I think, a better atmosphere that they have cultivated by not running as many giant arenas where 3,000 to 3,500 people feels very empty in an arena that can seat 10, as opposed to finding some of these smaller places that you can fill at 3,000 and it comes off hotter, it feels bigger, and is matching the demand that the public is showing for these week-to-week TVs. It's not the same as years gone by, where I think Dynamite had the big event feel that a lot of the early shows into the first couple of years had. Now the big event is the pay-per-view, especially, you know, something like an All in Texas of the traveling pay-per-views that they still have. And then the final area of interest was pay-per-view. And these stats are derived from the Wrestling Observer newsletter and what has been reported. And this was maybe the most interesting year for AEW pay-per-views, because on multiple occasions they faced head-to-head competition from first NXT PLEs, and then even in the case of All in Texas, that went against an NXT show in the afternoon, and then the beginning of the Saturday night's main event show that had Bill Goldberg's retirement back in July. And then all roads led to September, where All Out was scheduled to run in the evening of September 20th in Toronto. Then the announcement comes that WrestlePalooza is going to be running that night. And as we recall earlier in the discussion, that was around August 20th that they made that announcement. So about a month out from that. And AEW made the change to go in the afternoon, and WrestlePalooza would air in the evening. So they were facing the launch show on ESPN, a lot of promotion that WWE put into that event. And what was the result? We had All Out generating 138,000 buys, which is well up from All Out the year before. And it outperformed WrestleDream the following month. It outdid Forbidden Door. It outdid Double or Nothing. It outdid Dynasty, and came in right at the same level as Revolution. To me, All In was maybe the most important show of the year for the company, because that also faced competition. But in many ways, All Out was maybe your biggest win, because that was a show that you could have envisioned getting steamrolled with the thought that fans are going to have to make a decision here. Not only is, yes, people would have to, some would have to pay for the ESPN show, but a lot were going to be getting that with their existing ESPN subscription. And that was a big show. You had John Cena, you had Brock Lesnar, you had the return of AJ Lee. That was a big deal. And the thought was, you know, AEW running a pay-per-view that day, there were going to be a lot of people that were going to choose WWE over AEW, and that did not bear out. All Out held up very well. It also was the latest example, after All in Texas, of being able to run an afternoon show that has kind of opened up this door for AEW that they can explore. And I think what they learned this year is running in the afternoon was not their first objective, but their audience will follow them to the afternoon. It certainly is going to help for your overseas markets, where that's a much more palatable start time. And your U.S. audience showed me that they are willing to follow. If a show is worthy of their time, whether it starts at 2 in the afternoon or 8 at night, that's not going to be a giant difference. And that's very counter to what UFC had discovered in years past, when they had tinkered with their start time, even by an hour, back in 2011, and are going to be doing again with this launch on Paramount as well. So that, to me, those were the two shows that I think were the most interesting. WrestleDream was up from last year's WrestleDream, jumping from 105,000 buys to 120. Full Gear jumped from 113,000 to 140,000, and World's End moving from 115,000 buys to 140,000 buys. So you have to look at the overall performance of AEW's pay-per-views this year. And I think, like, the only sizable decrease was Revolution, which 2024 had the big Sting retirement. Revolution this year, while it was an excellent show, didn't have anything of the marquee value of Sting's retirement. So that was the only sizable decrease, and everything else was generally flat, above or just slightly below in the cases of Double or Nothing and Dynasty. I thought it was a great year for AEW pay-per-views. And why were these numbers up? I would say these last this last quarter, you have to look at the fact that they were now available on HBO Max, that being a factor. And the Hangman Page, Samoa Joe tie-in, MJF's return, you can look at those as contributing factors as well. But overall, their pay-per-views, I think, were in a very good place, especially at the end of 2025. And it offset a lot of head-to-head battles by WWE that could have hurt them a lot more than they ended up doing. So those were the AEW Q4 numbers. Brandon is into the vortex, so I do not know if he will be rejoining me or not. But before we get out of here, if anyone has any questions from any of these topics, I will be willing to take a couple of questions before we wrap things up. I'm going to go over the television numbers that we had been set to discuss, and then we will wrap things up for this week as we got through pretty much all of the main stories thus far. I will mention tomorrow night, Thursday, is TNA's launch on AMC. So it's a very big show for TNA, probably their biggest show in years because of the increase in platform. What is the move from an Access TV to an AMC? You're talking about probably in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 million more homes that they're going to be in on AMC. I mean, AMC is a significantly bigger network than Access TV. Is this going to be a game changer for TNA? That's tougher to ascertain. I'm sure they're going to do a very healthy number on Thursday. What is a healthy number? To me, we have not received Access TV numbers in years. The tail end of like 2023, they were doing like 80 to 100,000 viewers. So taking into all the accounts of all the loss of cable homes during those couple of years, I think if people are projecting 100,000 viewers, I think they should comfortably be above 100,000 viewers. But if we're talking 250, like that would be the area I'd be aiming for. Like this is not going to be an audience that is going to threaten to me your higher end wrestling programming, but there's a lot of promotion that's gone into this AMC launch. They've also got to turn around and do a pay-per-view on Saturday. So that's the dual function of Thursday show. They've got AJ Styles on the show. That meant a lot for Slammiversary back in July when he appeared. We'll see if that has a similar impact, pardon the pun. But yes, that'll be a very important show to watch, and mainly for the first month on AMC, what they settle into, because in theory, we should be getting regular TNA Impact viewership numbers from this point moving forward. Access was not getting, they were not being tallied by Nielsen. So we were getting nothing over the last couple of years. And you've been really limited in seeing like what audience they were even reaching on a weekly basis. So the television numbers and viewing as well. We go back to Raw from last week, which was the anniversary show. Very significant show that they had built up for a month with CM Punk defending the World Heavyweight Championship against Bron Breakker. They did 3.2 million global views. That was enough to rank 10th on the global charts. It was one of Raw's better numbers in months, hitting 3.2 million views. This comes as like part of this last month, as much as people can lament the fact Raw was outside of the top 10 global rankings, it wasn't just Stranger Things season 5. It was all 5 seasons of Stranger Things getting this incredible lift over the last month. Everyone was going back and watching all of the seasons. So all 5 seasons have been ranking every single week. Inevitably, that raises the floor of what number 10 is, and Raw was falling outside of it. It wasn't necessarily an indictment that Raw was suddenly losing this audience. It's just the floor had grown that much higher. But they were back in the global top 10 here. They ranked top 10 in 9 different countries. They ranked 6th in the US and Canada. So I mean, this is certainly not the level of a year ago, but at least in a very competitive Netflix landscape over this last while, they did perform very well. And the Stranger Things is going to die down now that the series is over, and inevitably these 5 seasons are going to Vanquish, and Ross should have a home in the top 10 as that occurs. SmackDown, though, which again doesn't air in the US on Netflix, this has they have really fallen. They were only ranking in Canada on Friday night show. This was for the January 9th show, which aired in the afternoon internationally from Germany. So yeah, one country it ranked in. Dynamite last Wednesday, it did 516,000 viewers and a 0.08 in the 18 to 49 demo. So it was up 30% in viewers, but this was compared to the prior week, which was on New Year's Eve, a terrible night, and was also going against the series finale of Stranger Things on Netflix. And speaking of Stranger Things, someone who was lost in the upside down, but might be joining us now. He is Brandon Thurston, who's never looked better. Brandon, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Barely.
All right. Is it really bad?
No. You sound okay. You sound like you're on a phone. It's you are here.
Yeah, I don't know. Completely disconnected from the internet. But
no. Okay. Well, we're just wrapping up with the television numbers, and then we are going to say goodbye here as we finished up the Q4 discussion and TNA moving to AMC. I was just going over Dynamite's number from last week, where they did get a jump in viewership from the New Year's Eve episode. SmackDown did 990,000 viewers, so that was down 16%. Again, this was for the show that aired in Germany live on Netflix and was on a multi-hour tape delay for those on the USA Network. A 0.26 in the demo, slightly down from the week before, this being their second week in the three-hour format. And then Collision averaged 271,000 viewers, which was up 12% from the week prior and doing an identical 0.03 on TNT. And those are our figures for the year. SmackDown fell under 1 million viewers, Brandon, so I assume it's going to be canceled.
1 million. It's the Raw number. Did you talk about that yet? The Raw number was good.
This was for the season premiere that they did a week ago, the Stranger Things tie-in episode. Yes, this was back in the top 10. What were your takeaways from that number? This did return them to the global top 10 rankings.
Was this heavily hyped? I mean, this was the highest number in weeks and weeks.
Yeah, they had made this a big deal. Like, they had promoted that Punk Braun Breaker match for about a month, and like, they really loaded this show up to be a significant episode of Raw.
I heard that nobody liked this episode, though.
Well, it turns out they may not have liked it, but they did tune in to watch it. So that's half the battle right there, is just get them in. Who cares what their opinion is of the show afterward? If you don't
half the cast were guest stars on the show, right?
No, none of the cast were guest stars on this. No David Harbour, no L. Nobody showed up for this, unfortunately. I know also that disappointed you.
Also a controversial ending from Stranger Things.
Yeah, did you have a definitive take on the end of Stranger Things? I mean,
I've never watched a single episode of Stranger Things.
Oh, including the finale. You didn't even bother to check in for the end.
No, I heard it was a controversial season finale or series finale.
Yeah, but CM Punk has told us, just be a fan. Shut up. Don't be critical.
Yeah, I mean,
the ethos of Punk.
That's a position that you can take, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, there you go. There's all your television viewerships. I'm just looking here about any questions that have come in. Question about Jericho showing up on AMC tomorrow. Can't completely rule it out, but I would not have him show up there first. I would not do that one if that was his return. Okay, we're just getting a lot of wrestling related questions here. I don't think Brandon has any thoughts on Braun Breaker winning the Royal Rumble this year.
What's better, WWE or AEW?
Since AEW in the UK has gone up, do you think some of that audience in the US has gone to Max, or are they not comparable?
I think this is the question we were supposed to answer last week.
Yeah, this was from Jumanji Hunter. Yes, I apologize. We missed this one last week.
Please do not file a class action lawsuit against us.
Yes, this is our make good. Since the UK audience has gone up, do you think some of that audience in the US has gone to the Max, or are they not comparable? I
don't know enough about what's going on. I know who's it, John Williams or someone from ITV is constantly tweeting, celebrating how good their ratings are. I just don't know. Are they in a different time slot? Is there some sort of external reason for that? Or is it just pure WWE or AEW has become much more popular?
Yeah. I think it's really hard to say. Like, I certainly look at least for the U.S. figures, when you see where the younger audience like has depleted so much, it's hard for me to imagine that that audience has just completely stopped watching, or that it was such a miscount under the panel data that you would naturally suspect that if you are losing audience to streaming, it's probably going to be that younger audience. So I think there is some of that. How much, it's like, we'd only be guessing. And I try to stay away from that because, like, we're just going based off of, like, your own assumptions. And you can't really back that up with any kind of evidence of what that is and what level of audience is tuning in a given week to any of these shows on streaming. But it's a good question to ask, just one that it's really hard to break down. All right. I think that that covers everything for this week. Brandon, thank you for rejoining us. And
how was it without me? You're used to doing this all the time, though, talking to you.
Oh, I was about to get into a heated argument with myself, so I appreciate you coming in when you did. Things were going to get physical, so I do appreciate that. Hopefully, I did your absence justice. People missed you in those couple of minutes. But we will be back next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, video pending, but we plan to be back. And you can catch all of Brandon's work over at WrestleNomics.com and Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, where you can catch up on all of the latest television viewership data. The AEW Q4 report for 2025, that is up with the charts, and you can listen for free to his show with Josh Nason over at WrestlingObserver.com. And he is not a stranger to postwrestling.com, frequently dropping news and analysis over on our site as well, which is where you can find my work. Tonight, I am back with Wei Ting. We will be live right after Maximum Carnage, as we will be reviewing AEW's show from Phoenix, Arizona tonight, featuring MJF and Bandido. So, on behalf of the spreadsheet pervert, I am John Pollock, and thank you to all for watching this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston.